congregation for the opportunity to have been with you. I appreciate the elders asking me to come. I'm appreciative of this particular study, allowing me to go back and look at the lives of some incredible people. People whose lives are exemplary. People whose lives altered the course of living in the days in which they lived, in some cases for years after the specific events that we've referenced. And I don't know if I said this earlier in the week, but I want to say it to you now. Whenever you read historical narratives, whether it be these events that we've discussed throughout the course of this week, whether it be the history of the life of Jesus and the four Gospels, put yourself in the story. Become one of the characters. I'm not a fast reader. I'm an average reader, but I like to read a great deal, both spiritual material as well as novels, and particularly espionage, spy, Tom Clancy-type materials. I become one of the characters when I read those books. It makes the book come alive to me. And I transferred that to Scripture, and I've begun to develop a whole new appreciation for the historical narratives that we find. I become David when I read the stories of David. I became his brothers this time to try and get a perspective of what I would have thought had my runt of a little brother come and said, "Well, I'll take on the giant," wondering how I would have responded. I don't know if I conveyed that well to you last night. It was a novel idea on my part, at least from my perspective, and I don't know that I adequately got the job done. But I believe it'll make a difference in how you read. I was talking with an individual last night as they were leaving, and she talked about how different she now, some things have come to light that she didn't see when she read her Bible before, as she listens to it now and someone else reads it. And there's an emphasis here that in the reading by the people who are reading that she had never made when she read herself or had heard others read. And I would encourage you to listen to Scripture read that way as well, because all of a sudden, lights start coming on. And it's quite a wonderful experience. And so I'm thankful for the invitation to be with you and the opportunity to look at the lives of these people, to realize again, to recognize again, as we've tried to stress always, these are real folks. And they're everyday common folks who do extraordinary, uncommon things. But they don't do it because they're so uncommon and so extraordinary, but because they're God. Is so uncommon and extraordinary. And tonight's character is no different. He's getting shortchanged. Because I'm going to wrap this up going to Ephesians chapter 6, much like the children are doing in the back, and try to tie all of this together tonight. So we'll not spend as much time with Elisha, although, boy, we could. 50 plus years of service. The historical narrative goes from 1 Kings 19 to 2 Kings 13. And seldom is the sequel as good as the original, but Elisha is right there with his predecessor, Elijah, in terms of the kind of man he was and the kinds of things that he did. While Elijah focused on dealing with the idolatrous people of his day, Elisha seemed to have a ministry to the poor and to the downtrodden. And there was a compassion about him that's extraordinary. And that's seen in one of the chapters we're going to look at tonight. 18, I believe, encounters between Elijah and needy people. Elisha and needy people in those chapters, actually starting in 2 Kings in the first 13 chapters, where he touches the lives of needy people. How many needy people's lives have you touched? I tell you what, I get kind of callous. We get phone calls, "Oh, I'm passing through town and I'm on my way from this place to this place. And my car's broke down, and my dog has died, and my wife's about to leave me. And if I don't get X amount of dollars to get from here to there, I'm going to lose my job." And I don't know how many, if any, of those were ever legitimate. I know some that weren't, because the same guy called me up. I actually came to the church building twice, exactly a year apart, with the exact same story. His mother died and he needed a train, a bus fare to St. Louis. He denied it, but he was the same guy with the same story. Same guy one time came with the same story about a flat tire. I bought into it, gave him money. About 3 months later, I thought he was coming to pay me back. We were having a business meeting, and he walked in, talked to two of the men, and I was involved in the discussion, so I couldn't encounter him, and off he went. I went back to those two men afterward, hoping that he was returning my money to me, only to find out he had fleeced them for the same amount that he had fleeced me for, with exactly the same story, so I had to apologize to them for not stopping them before they did it. Those kind of things happen to you often enough. You start to get a little callous and a little jaded, and needy people become a burden. They don't seem to burden Elisha. We're going to look tonight at Elisha's commission and ours. And we'll spend time, most of our time, with regard to Elisha in 2 Kings, although we'll reference some things in 1 Kings, the 19th chapter. And then we're going to spend some time in the New Testament talking about our commission as well. We're going to talk about the commissioning of Elisha, the persistence of Elisha, the confidence of Elisha, and then we're going to try and wrap up the whole week by talking about our warfare, our being called into the service of God, and who our enemy is and how we're going to deal with him. That's probably a whole series of lessons in and of itself, and you're going to get a Reader's Digest version of it tonight. Let's look for just a moment at the commissioning of Elisha. I'm going to be reading these texts from the New International Version, 1 Kings chapter 19, beginning with verse 19. God has already told Elijah to go and anoint Elisha as his successor. So this is what Elisha does. He goes from where he was, and he finds Elisha, the son of Shaphat. He was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen, and he himself was driving the 12th pair. Elijah went up to him and threw his cloak around him. Elisha then left his oxen and ran after Elijah. "Let me kiss my father and mother goodbye," he said, "and then I will come with you." "Go back," Elijah replied. "What have I done to you?" So Elisha left him, went back. He took his yoke of oxen and slaughtered them. He burned the plowing equipment to cook the meat and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he set out to follow Elisha and become his attendant. Almost reminiscent, when you stop and think about it, of Jesus calling some of his 12. He finds them at their occupation, and he tells them, "Come and follow me." It's essentially what Elijah does on this particular circumstance with Elijah. And he throws his mantle, he throws his cloak around Elisha, signifying something rather significant to the people of that day. It may not have meant as much to us when you read that. You may have thought that was a rather strange thing. But he's saying to Elisha, to anyone who's witnessing this event, to us who read it, that this is the one who's going to succeed me. This is the one who's going to take my place when I'm finished. And so Elisha cooks the two oxen that he has been plowing with. He gives the meat to the people and they all eat. And he follows Elisha and becomes his attendant and ministers to him. A little picture of what it means to take up our cross and follow Jesus long before Jesus ever utters those words. He's leaving his home. He's leaving his family. And he's going to follow Elijah around and attend to him, much like those 12 men did to our Lord. It's going to be quite an exciting ride if you're Elisha. You're going to be in for some rather wonderful, mind-changing, life-altering experiences that are going to serve you well later in life. But we want to skip ahead to the second chapter. And there's a persistence, probably wasn't the best word, as we look at the first four verses and the sixth verse of this particular text. But he is persistent. But I believe he's persistent because of his loyalty. His loyalty to both his God and to this one who's called him to minister to him and to eventually take his place as the man of God to the people of Israel. Verse 1 of chapter 2 in 2 Kings. When the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. And Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here. The Lord has sent me to Bethel." But Elisha said, "As surely as the Lord lives, and as you live, I will not leave you." And so they went to Bethel. The company of the prophets at Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, "Do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today?" "Yes, I know," Elisha replied, "but do not speak of it." Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, Elisha. The Lord has sent me to Jericho." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives, and as you live, I will not leave you." So they went to Jericho. Then Elijah said to him, "Stay here. The Lord," verse 6, "the Lord has sent me to the Jordan." And he replied, "As surely as the Lord lives, and as you live, I will not leave you." So the two of them walked on. The text doesn't give us any information as to why Elijah does this with Elisha. Is he testing him? Now, that may be it. Is he giving him an opportunity to walk away from what he has been called to? Elisha's response makes it clear, "No, I signed up for the duration. As long as the Lord lives." He doesn't say, "as long as I live." He said, "as long as the Lord lives, as long as you live, I'm not leaving. You know, I hitch myself to you, and I'm in this for the duration." How many people do you know who test Christianity like they do the water in the swimming pool or the lake that first warm day of the year to see if that temperature is just right? "Well, okay, I'll jump in." And so they do this with their foot. If it's too cold, they withdraw and they go on their way. I've seen some people who thought that that's how they would see about Christianity. They give it a shot. Christianity is not something you give a shot to or at. Christianity is something you decide. You're going to make it your life, or you don't bother at all. As a matter of fact, I'm convinced that the most miserable of people are those believers who are giving it a shot, who are trying it out, who haven't really allowed Christianity to envelop them, they've not allowed Christianity to become the core of who they are. They're more or less playing at it, and they know enough that it makes them miserable. But they're not committed enough to just embrace it entirely and let it be the motivation of their life. I'm convinced the work that Elisha has been called to, that he has embraced, that he has been doing now for several years in his young life, he's not about to turn loose of. "No, as long as the Lord lives, as long as you live, I'm going with you. I'm not going to leave you." From Gilgal to Bethel to Jericho, he makes these affirmations. "As surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you." What commitment and loyalty. Remember, we've already read a story this week where Gideon was told, "Offer the men who are frightened the opportunity to go home." And 22,000 took him up on the offer. Here, Elisha is being offered the opportunity to stay. "You don't have to go with me." And he's refusing. As a matter of fact, if you look, understanding all that's about to transpire, notice what he says in verse 9. After they'd crossed, Elisha said to Elisha, "Tell me, what can I do for you before I'm taken from you?" Elisha responds, "Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit." Elisha says, "You've asked a difficult thing. Yet if you see me when I'm taken from you, it will be yours. Otherwise not." Elisha wants a double portion. Firstborn in Israel always received a double portion of his father's inheritance. This relationship between these two men had developed much that it seems as though it were a father and son relationship of sort. And Elijah says to Elisha, "Before I go, what can I give you? What one thing do you ask of me?" And Elisha says, "I'd like a double portion." a double portion of your spirit. Well, that really wasn't Elijah's to give, per se. Not if he's talking about the abilities to do the kinds of things that Elijah did that were of a miraculous nature. But he asks, and Elijah says, well, if you see me when I'm taken, it'll be yours. Otherwise not. Well, what happens? Let's look, beginning with verse 11. As they were walking along together and talking, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them. Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. And Elisha saw this and cried out, "My father! My father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel!" And Elisha saw him no more. Then he took hold of his own clothes and he tore them apart. Generally, you saw men rent their clothes and then they would pour ashes on their head in lamentation at the loss of someone who was dear to them, at the loss of great people. And that is probably what's happening here, at least in part. I don't know if he has forgotten already what Elisha has told him about the double portion, or Elijah has told him about the double portion. If I do that, please put the right people in the right place. Know if I'm talking about Elijah, if it slips out and it's Elisha instead. And just give me the benefit of the doubt that I've got those guys right in my head. It's just not coming right out of my mouth. Chariots of fire. Horses of fire. And we say, oh, if I could only see that. You can. You can see it with your mind's eye. And you need to allow the words on this page to have the same impact on you that the sight had upon Elisha as he witnessed that event, looking up into the sky. You need to draw that picture mentally in your mind. However your imagination works, and however wondrous that scene appears, it probably does not even come close to the reality of what Elisha witnesses on this occasion. But you need to experience it. It's not just words on a page. It's not, yeah, oh yeah, he saw a chariot of fire with some horses of fire. I will just go on. You need to allow that to impact you, just as it impacted him. Well, after he rents his clothes, continue with the reading in verse 13. He picks up the cloak that had fallen from Elijah. And he went back and he stood on the bank of the Jordan, and then he took the cloak that had fallen from him and he struck the water with it. "Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" he asked. And when he struck the water, it divided to the right and to the left, and he crossed over. And the company of the prophets from Jericho who were watching said, "The spirit of Elijah is resting on Elisha." And they went to meet him and bowed to the ground before him. Is this a man who's not sure what he just saw? And is this a man who's not certain he'd been a recipient of the promise that Elijah made to him, that if he saw him taken, he'd receive his double portion of the Spirit? These men who witnessed what's happening here as he strikes the water with the cloak and it parts, they understand. The mantle has passed. Not only literally, not only does Elisha now possess the cloak, but the power that Elijah had now resides in Elisha as well. And these men, these, as the NIV calls them, the company of the prophets, some translations and commentators refer to this as a school of the prophets, that there were school of prophets in Bethel and in Gilgal, and they were men who were being trained by prophets, trained to speak, to tell forth the Word of God, and to function as prophets in some capacity. They recognize who Elisha is now and what he is all about. And a number of miracles transpire between this particular point in time in Elisha's life and chapter 6, where we want to go next. And in chapter 6, we see Elisha's confidence, and it's a quiet confidence. It really is. There's a display of meekness here about this man that I think we need to embrace, gentlemen. All of us do, male or female, but particularly those of us who have a tendency to like the machismo, and we like to talk about crushing our enemy, you know, like a worm. That's not what we see in the spirit of Elisha on this particular occasion. Begin reading with verse 8 of chapter 6. And what you find here is Elisha really is the precursor to the modern day Mossad, which is the Israeli spy intelligence agency. Now, he does it by different means than the Mossad does it today, but he frustrates the enemy to no end. Now, the king of Aram was at war with Israel. After conferring with his officers, he said, "I will set up my camp in such and such a place." So here's what we're going to do, is we're going to deal with Israel as we're about to attack them. We're going to go to this place and we're going to set up our camp. Verse 9, the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, "Beware of passing that place because the Arameans are going down there." So the king of Israel checked on the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elisha warned the king so that he was on his guard in such places. Oh, word gets back to the king of Aram. And he's enraged, verse 11. He summoned his officers and demanded of them, "Will you not tell me which of us is on the side of the king of Israel? We've got a mole here. We've got a leak. And we've got to close this leak up. Every time I go here, thinking I'm going to be able to wage my battle and set a trap for the king of Israel and his army, he knows about it. And how's this happening?" His first inclination is, it's one of his own people. Well, his own people tell him, "It's none of us. We're not doing this." But Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the very words you speak in your bedroom. Now, our government prides itself on having satellite capability that can read a license plate from who knows how many miles up. Elisha knew what the king was saying in his bedroom long before we had the technology that we have today. At least that's how these men understood what was going on. This man knows what's happening. This prophet in Israel knows what's happening. He knows what you're doing. He knows what you tell your military men to do. He even knows what's happening in your bedroom. Well, the king decides, "I've got to put a stop to this. We're going to capture Elisha," in verse 13. So he says, "Go find out where he is," the king ordered, "so that I can send men to capture him." Well, the report comes back. He's in Dothan. And so the king sends horses and chariots and a strong force there. And they went by night and they surround the entire city. Elisha's servant, maybe someone much like a role to him that he had been to Elijah, but at the very least a servant, is quite alarmed by all that's taking place. Verse 15. When the servant of the man of God got up and went out early the next morning, an army with horses and chariots surrounded the city. "Oh, my Lord, what shall we do?" the servant asked. I think it's interesting to see how Elisha is described here. He's the man of God. That's how the text refers to him. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we were noted as a man of God or a woman of God, that by how we comport ourselves, how we behave, how we function in the communities in which we live, people can tell that we are indeed people of God. His servant says, "My Lord, I don't know what we're going to do. How are we going to deal with this? We are surrounded. The enemy has us surrounded and they've come for you. How are we going to deal with this?" Much like Jesus, Elisha's response is, "Don't be afraid." You and I need to learn to listen to those words. In those times when we are uncomfortable, in those times when we are indeed afraid of what is in front of us and what we have to deal with, we have to hear Jesus saying to us, as he did to his disciples, we need to hear, what the servant hears Elisha saying to him in those same kinds of circumstances, don't be afraid. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Now, can you imagine the servant looking around and wondering who in the world Elisha is talking about? He doesn't see all that many folks around him. It may be that these two are having a private conversation and he doesn't see anyone else around him. But he's pretty certain those that are encircling the city, waiting to capture Elisha, far outnumber whoever it is that's there in Dothan with Elisha and the servant. But he says, don't be afraid. Reminiscent of a New Testament text in Romans. If God is for us, who can be against us? Do we really believe that text? And again, every element of the lives of the people we've talked about, or the main element of every one of the lives of the people we've talked about throughout this week, is their tremendous confidence in and faith in the God of heaven. And you're going to see it again displayed right here. Notice what Elijah does. And he does it twice here. He equips himself with prayer. He tells this man, don't be afraid. Those who are with us far outnumber those who are with them. And then he prays this way in the first half of the 17th verse. O Lord, open his eyes so that he may see. Maybe we need the eyes of our heart enlightened, opened. To see. We need to go to the 11th chapter of Hebrews and read about those people and then continue on into the 12th chapter and know that those folks are there for our benefit. They are encompassing us. They are the folks who we really need to listen for their cheers and their words of encouragement. Now, he doesn't see necessarily those people unless they're the ones occupying what he does see. And the Lord opens the servant's eyes. He sees something quite remarkable in the 17th verse, in the latter half of the 17th verse. The Lord opens the servant's eyes, and he looked, and he saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. I want you to imagine that scene. Put yourself in the place of the servant. You don't know how your Lord is going to escape this. You're pretty certain that it's going to mean, at the very least, it's going to mean capture. At the worst, it may mean death for both you and your master. But he's told you not to be afraid, that those with you outnumber those that are with them, and he has told you, or he has prayed in your presence that your eyes be opened, and now as you look around, you see chariots of fire and horses of fire all around you. Elijah's not done praying. He continues to pray in verse 18. As the enemy came down towards him, as they're enclosing their ranks on him to take him captive, he prays to the Lord, strike these people with blindness. And so he struck them with blindness as Elisha had asked. They must have stopped dead in their tracks. They don't know where to go. They can't find him in the circumstance in which they find themselves. So he leads the enemy into the hands of the king of Israel, verse 19 through 21. Elisha told them, this is not the road and this is not the city. Follow me and I will lead you to the man you are looking for. And he led them to Samaria. And after they entered the city, Elisha said, Lord, open the eyes of these men so they can see. And then the Lord opened their eyes and they looked, and there they were inside Samaria. And when the king of Israel saw them, he asked Elisha, shall I kill them, my father? Shall I kill them? Isn't that what we would expect? They've come to capture the man of God so that they then in turn could deal with Israel militarily. Wouldn't that be a question most of us would have answered in the affirmative were we Elisha? Certainly. Kill them all. We'll send their heads back to the king of Aram as a message. Don't monkey with us. Don't come and try to do anything here with the man of God on our side. Look at what we can do. Look at how we can deal with this circumstance. After all, what's the military trained to do? Whether it was an ancient military or a modern military, it's trained to destroy and to kill. But what's Elisha's response on this occasion? Verse 22, 23, do not kill them. Would you kill men you have captured with your own sword or bow? Set food and water before them so that they might eat and drink and then go back to their master. So he prepared a great feast for them. What compassion. What strength manifested in mercy. And he sends them back then after it's all done. And it has its desired effect. Read the rest of verse 23. And after they had finished eating and drinking, he sent them away and they returned to their master. So the bands of Aram stopped raiding Israel's territory. They leave the prophet alone and they leave Israel alone, at least for a time. We need more men, more people like Elisha. People who are going to understand their commitment and who are going to be persistent in maintaining it. People who are going to have the kind of faith that in the throes of potential capture and or death, their first inclination isn't to strike out. He doesn't call lightning down from heaven to destroy everyone. He prays. He prays that his servant would be able to see and that the enemy would be blinded. And then rather than destroying the enemy with compassion, he says, feed them and send them back. That's what you need to do. And we need to be like that. Like these heroes of old, whether it be Elisha or David or Gideon or Deborah and Barak or Joshua, we are involved in conflict. Our war is not over territory. It is not over vital resources. It's not about bragging rights. Our warfare is described in this way. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 3 and 4. For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not weapons of the world. They're not carnal weapons. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. That's what these folks used. Joshua, Deborah, Gideon, David, and Elisha. Whose power do they use to gain the victories in the various events and battles that we saw them fight? It's divine power that demolishes strongholds. And we're promised that same power in our warfare. Look at 1 Peter chapter 2, verses 11 and 12. Dear friends, I urge you as aliens and strangers in the world to abstain from sinful desires, which what? Which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day He visits us. Isn't that statement true of all of these ancients that we've looked at? Weren't they that kind of people who lived such godly lives that even though they might have been accused of wrongdoing, ultimately people saw the quality of life that they lived and it made a difference? Not only did the Israelites know who the God of heaven was, but so did other people. So did the people of the nations around about them. Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12, for our struggle. If you're a believer, if you are a Christian, you are in a conflict, you are in a struggle. And Paul says, it's not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realm. And like these heroes of old, we're going to face our walls. We're going to come up against a brick wall, a fortified wall that we're going to have to figure out how to deal with. We're going to come up against our giants in life. Those odds that seem insurmountable. Against an opponent who's going to use every imaginable weapon he can find in his arsenal. And He'll exploit every weakness that He can sense or see in who we are as people. He prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour, 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 8. And he disguises himself as an angel of light, 2 Corinthians 11, 14. And when you stop and think about all of that, how in the world can I face such a one? How am I going to deal with the devil, who doesn't care who he hurts or who he uses to accomplish his ends? What hope does Keith have when Keith looks back at human history, going all the way back to the garden and Adam and Eve, and seeing failure after failure after... If that's what I want to focus on, I'll find an awful lot of failure in this world. Quite frankly, Scripture even tells me more people fail than succeed. How am I going to deal with this? How do we fight against the powers of this dark world, against principalities and powers of this dark world? Well, if you haven't figured it out by now, I haven't done my job. Because we do it the same way that a Rahab and a Joshua do it. We do it the same way that a Deborah and a Barak do it. We do it the same way that Gideon accomplished it. We do it the same way David does. And we do it the same way that Elisha did. We have to develop the same kind of faith. This unrelenting trust in the God of heaven. The God who is the God of heaven above and of earth below. The God of heaven whom we read about, who does all of these mighty, wondrous things that these people saw with their own eyes that we need to imagine ourselves seeing, so that we can be impacted in a like fashion. We have to do what Paul says in Ephesians chapter 6, beginning with verse 10. We need to be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. All of these people trusted in that. Not a one of them trusted in themselves. They trusted in the Lord and in the power of His might. And then we need to put on the full armor of God so that we can take our stand against the devil's schemes. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the powers of this dark world, and against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly realms. And therefore, we should put on the full armor of God so that when the day of evil comes, you may be able to stand your ground, and after you have done everything, to stand. You know what he's saying? And maybe I've simplified this too much. I don't have to be the one who actually slays the devil. Jesus, quite frankly, has already done that. What do I have to do when it's all said and done? When I'm fighting the battle and all of the smoke settles, what is it that I should be doing? Still standing. That's all. I'll be bruised. I'll be bloodied. I'll be dirtied. But if I can develop the same kind of faith and resolve these individuals did that we've been studying about, when the dust settles, I'm still standing. In the clearing stands a fighter and a boxer by his trade. And he carries the reminder of every glove that laid him down or cut him till he cries out in his anger and his shame, I'm leaving. I'm leaving. But the fighter still remains. Any of you going back to the 70s, and Kathy keeps telling me I've got to update my illustrations. Simon and Garfunkel, the boxer. I believe that's what's being told to me in Ephesians chapter 6. I'll remember every glove, every blow that the devil has used to knock me down. I'll remember every cut and every bruise. But in the end, if I can develop the kind of faith that these people did, the Elishas and the Davids and the Gideons and the Barak, when it's all over, I'm standing. I'm still there. Bruised and beaten and bloodied, but why should it be any different? That's how my Lord has given me the victory. Why should it be any different from me? I need to stand firm with the belt of truth buckled around my waist, with the breastplate of righteousness, in place and with my feet fitted with the readiness that comes from the gospel of peace. In addition to all this, take up the shield of faith with which you can extinguish all the flaming arrows of the evil one. Take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God, and pray. Pray in the Spirit on all occasions with all kinds of prayers and requests. And with this in mind, be alert and always keep on praying for all the saints. What an example of that Elisha was in our text this evening. We've studied about those who are dead and yet still speak to us today. The recorded histories of their lives serve as examples for those of us who desire to be people of faith. And the challenge for us this week has been to find out how these individuals function in the face of great difficulty and calamity and war, and how they were able to touch the lives of people and affect the world in which they lived in a positive, godly way. The question for us is whether or not we will accept that challenge. Will we take up the mantle? You've been equipped this week. A mantle has been placed on you. A cloak has been handed to you. Will you leave here and be better? Will you leave here and make an impact in the communities in which you live, where you work, where you go to school, in your families? Are you ready to face your giants? How will you do that? We all have them. What will you do when the oppressive weight of hardship overcomes you? How will you deal with it? When confronted with evil, are you going to be willing, gentlemen, to take the advice of a woman? And ladies, are you going to be willing to take your own advice? You know, Deborah went. She said, "You go, Barak." Barak said, "I will if you will." And she went. She led by being out in front. Ladies, you willing to accept that responsibility? The obstacles in front of us are substantial. How will you overcome them? I believe the one who is in us is greater than the one who is in the world. 1 John 4, verse 4. Let's close with the reading of Hebrews chapter 11, verse 32 beginning. And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised again to life. Others were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and ill-treated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith. I don't believe there'd be anything put on your tombstone that would speak more highly of you than what's expressed in verse 38. The world was not worthy of them. And what's expressed in verse 39 hopefully can be said of us when our life is over, that our life was commendable, and it was commendable because we were people of faith. If you're not a Christian, you've got an uphill battle to live the rest of your life, a life in which you don't have the promise of the God of heaven to aid you and helping you deal with all the demons in your life, helping you with the devil, helping you with the giants that you face and the walls that you'll confront. But if you obey the gospel of Jesus Christ, you have the promise of His presence in your life. And you have the promise of Scripture that God can work mightily in you to do more than you even ask or imagine. But you have to be His child. You have to be a part of His family. You have to accept the call or the commission to be a soldier in His army. And that opportunity is afforded to you tonight. Maybe you just need the help of your brethren. You'd like them to pray for you like Elijah prayed for his servant. Whatever the case may be, we encourage you to come while we stand and sing. Some say you'll